Hello and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Thursday, April 11th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. Looking at the front page, we have at the very top, across the front, headline, Grant to Fund Youth Climate Action. This is reported by Benjamin Fisher. Dubuque is one of 100 cities across the globe selected for a new grant program to engage young residents in projects to help address climate change. Bloomberg Philanthropies and the city announced Wednesday that Dubuque will receive $50,000 to distribute through micro-grants of $1,000 to $5,000 each for projects that will galvanize area youth ages 15 to 24 to design and produce climate solutions, according to a press release. Dubuque is one of 23 communities in the U.S. to be included in the group of 100 from around the world. The program was announced at Bloomberg Philanthropies' Mayor's Innovation Studio at COP28, the United Nations Climate Change Conference, held in Dubai late last year, which Dubuque Mayor Brad Kavanaugh and City Director of Sustainability Gina Bell attended. I don't think people, and maybe especially young people, are thinking locally when they think of climate action, Kavanaugh said Wednesday. A lot of the conversation gets stuck at the international and national level. What Bloomberg Philanthropies are recognizing is, if we're going to tackle this global problem, maybe where people are going to feel most comfortable to engage is right where they live. The fact that we get the opportunity to be a part of this group along across the whole world and to get funding for it to start it is really exciting. In announcing the grant, Kavanaugh issued a call for project pitches by Dubuque's young people. The release states that qualifying projects may include youth-led awareness, education, research, and development efforts, such as climate-related education programs, hackathons, surveys and research, clubs and curricular and public art and awareness campaigns, youth-driven climate mitigation and adaptation initiatives, such as community gardening, tree planting, reforestation, and urban farming campaigns, recycling and waste reduction programs, and climate resilience workshops and disaster preparedness programs, co-governed youth climate action plans, such as partnerships between city leaders and youth groups to inform public climate policy ideas or actions, or the formation of youth climate ambassadors or advisory boards. Bell said the city intended to leave the project possibilities open-ended, in part because Bloomberg's application for the grants was as well. What they asked us for in our application was, what are two or three potential projects you would use this money for, she said. We included a public art campaign related to the impacts of climate change on the community, a youth-led bike ride to raise awareness that many youths in the community don't have access to a car and need safe routes to travel, and engaging Marshallese youth to highlight their community's grand challenges related to sea level rise in their native country and how they continue to work toward habitat recovery while living here in the United States. But those were my ideas. What the youth will come up with will drive this. The main qualification projects need to meet is that they must work toward the goals of the City of Dubuque's Climate Action Plan. To help applicants integrate these goals, the city created an idea bank of the action plan's various topics to spark ideas. Cities that succeed in committing all $50,000 of the grant within 6 months will receive another $100,000 to support additional youth-driven projects over the course of a year, the release states. Bell acknowledged that 6 months is a tight turnaround for the first $50,000 to be distributed, but said Dubuque is a few steps ahead. We're in the unique position that we already have a sustainability grant, but one that has a lot more strings than this grant, she said. I think that this is good because if the relative freedom in how we can distribute it. Then there's the incentive. $100,000 is a huge carrot to try and go for, especially in a really tight budget session. City officials said they would be open to applications by individuals or groups, including youth service organizations, as long as their project is driven by the youth they serve. Bell said she specifically included offering the microgrants to young people in Dubuque and the surrounding area, including Grant County, Wisconsin, and Joe Davis County, Illinois, but said projects in the city of Dubuque likely would receive particular consideration. More information is available at sustainabledubuque.org/YCAF. The article is accompanied by a couple of photographs of those mentioned in the article, Brad Kavanaugh and Gina Bell. And a second story on the front page, along the left side column, is headlined, Advocates Seek to Break Down Sexual Assault Misconceptions. It's reported by Maya Bond. Maya's name is spelled M-A-I-A. Maya Bond reports, while the number of sexual assaults in Dubuque has declined in recent years, law enforcement and local advocates say the crime is one that remains vastly underreported. However, both seek to address that trend by providing resources and pushing back against misconceptions that can lead victims to remain silent. That work especially is highlighted during April, which is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, though local leaders work year-round to provide care and support that can range from helping victims find stable housing to helping them prepare for a trial. When a survivor musters up the courage or comes to a place where they want to say something, that's almost unspeakable. What they often find is the systems that they then need to interact with aren't always designed well for people who are living under unresolved trauma, said Gwen Bramlett Hecker, executive director of the nonprofit Riverview Center. Data from the Dubuque Police Department indicates that reported sexual assaults have dropped in recent years, spiking to 105 in 2020 before declining annually to 73 in 2023. However, sexual assaults also are one of the least reported crimes nationally, with just 33.9% of rape and sexual assaults ultimately reported to police in 2019, according to data compiled by Pew Research Center. Dubuque Police Department Lieutenant Luke Bach said officers do what they can to make victims feel comfortable so more individuals will report when they are sexually assaulted. Reporters seek to conduct interviews in more private places and to be out of uniform during the interviews. They also loop in advocates from Riverview Center to ensure victims are not re-traumatized during the legal process. Leaders of area organizations serving people who have been sexually assaulted say common misconceptions about the crime can leave victims feeling guilty, isolated, and without control over their situation. That can lead them to not seek help. Bramlett Hecker, whose organization serves victims of sexual violence in 14 Iowa counties and victims of sexual and domestic violence in 2 Illinois counties, said victims often are blamed for the crime committed against them and told it was their fault. And children can be blamed for not speaking up sooner about the abuse they have endured. She noted that false reports of sexual assaults happen extremely infrequently. As the majority of victims of sexual assault are women, the myth that false reports of sexual assault are a common issue can perpetuate beliefs about women being manipulative. Darlene Masters, executive director of Family Advocates Incorporated, said trauma has a profound effect on a person's brain. Family Advocates serves Grant, Iowa, and Lafayette counties in Wisconsin, and offers a shelter for domestic violence and sexual assault victims, a 24-hour crisis helpline, a support group, and advocacy for victims. As victims of sexual assault navigate the healthcare, judicial, and legal systems, it is important to have a consistent person by their side offering support, Masters said. It is one of the most personal crimes that can be committed against someone, and it can be very shameful, a lot of self-blame, a lot of guilt that goes into a circumstance when someone is sexually assaulted, she said. She said, while there has been more national publicity acknowledging sexual assault in recent years, many victims are still not believed or are blamed for what happened to them, so they do not speak up about it. She said sexual assault is about the perpetrator gaining power and control. It doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't matter what you wear. It doesn't matter where you were. You did not deserve what happened to you, she said. Masters said it is important for sexual assault victims to know they have control over their options. If they are 18 or older, they can go to a hospital without reporting the crime to police. She said there are resources available regardless of whether they choose to report the crime to law enforcement, such as help with securing housing, mental health care, and food assistance. Bramlett Hecker said Riverview Center advocates frequently are called to area hospitals to support patients who have been sexually assaulted. Their services often start by informing the patient of their options and giving them the power to choose what avenue they want to take. It's very difficult to muster the trust of strangers that you have to talk to and share these intimate details with when the biggest loss you've now experienced is your ability to trust others and yourself, she said. These systems are really, really challenging for survivors and often what keeps them silent for so long. She also said many individuals don't connect the dots between the trauma they are carrying and the struggles they face in daily life. It is just a huge step in healing to understand that the harm that happened to them years ago continues to hold them, and if we can help them crack open that shell and shine some light on it, it's amazing the resiliency of survivors and how far they can move beyond that then, she said. And that was reported by Maya Bond, and it is a report for AmeriCorps. She's a report for AmeriCorps member. There's also a picture of Darlene Matthews, who is mentioned in the article, as well as Gwen Bramlett Hecker. And a third story on the front page has a large picture. Color picture of, let me give it, read the caption. It says, store manager Nate Robinson shows off the stuffed peppers being served for lunch at Driftless Market in Platteville, Wisconsin on Wednesday. Imperfect-looking produce has been redirected from the store's shelves to its deli to minimize food waste. Pictures taken by Stephen Gassman of the Telegraph Herald, and it's reported by Grace Nyland, and the headline says, every little bit helps. Randy Thole, T-H-O-L-E, isn't afraid of a little competition. Thole works as manager of plant engineering at the Progressive Processing Plant on Dubuque's Chevenel Road. The plant employs more than 500 people to manufacture shelf-stable meat products for its parent company, Hormel Foods. As such, the site is one of many to compete in Hormel's annual Sustainability Best of the Best competition aimed at recognizing and incentivizing sustainability initiatives across its facilities nationwide. The Dubuque plant has seen some top 10 finishes in the past, Thole said, but the facility hit it big last year after implementing a reverse osmosis project that reduced its annual water consumption by 7.28 million gallons for a cost savings of more than $100,000. Our facility actually took first place in the 2023 competition, Thole said. There's a lot of really neat projects going on throughout our company, so it was really cool to be part of the first place team. The project is one of several sustainability initiatives taking place at the plant and one of many more being implemented across the tri-state area as businesses and residents alike increasingly turn toward greener practices. According to an IBM Institute for Business Value surveys, 62% of U.S. consumers are willing to change their purchasing habits to reduce environmental impact. And a growing portion of corporate executives are listing sustainability as a business consideration. Southwest Wisconsin Technical College Energy Coordinator Ashley Wotalowicz, I'm going to spell that, W-O-J-T-A-L-E-W-I-C-Z, Wotalowicz, said the benefits of such efforts are varied and that business leaders often are motivated not only by environmental concerns, but also the marketability and profitability of such moves. There's a lot of reason why, but the result is that demand is increasing for sustainable projects and people who know how to do them, she said. Locally, such efforts vary widely in terms of both scope and strategy. At Driftless Market in Platteville, Wisconsin, co-owner Royal Palmer said several tactics are in place to minimize the grocer and deli's environmental footprint. The retail area uses biodegradable grocery bags and sells many items in bulk. Imperfect-looking produce has been redirected from the store's shelves to its deli to minimize food waste. The produce is still fresh and safe to eat, but might have a small bruise or odd shape that would dissuade a consumer purchase, Palmer said. Scraps from the deli are composted and transported to a local farm to be used as fertilizer. Rather than sending it to a landfill to produce methane, we wanted to find a way those scraps could be repurposed, Palmer said. We take the compost up to a farm in Cuba City, Wisconsin, so it's helping a local farmer too. Progressive Processing also took steps to reduce its food waste last year, Toll said, and implemented a new program to divert portions of meat not used in the plant's final product to be converted into animal feed. We basically wanted to find a way to upcycle that waste product, Toll said. As a result, the plant decreased the food waste it sent to the landfill by 31.4%. Other initiatives come in the form of upgrades to businesses' physical location. When Matthew Carroll opened Jail Hill Inn in Galena, Illinois in 2015, he performed a major renovation on the 19th century building that previously operated as the Joe Davis County Jail. Carroll invested up front in a water heater that cuts energy use by heating only drawn upon water and a $20,000 in-floor heating system. Both were more expensive than traditional options, he said, but cost savings from the decreased utility bills already have covered and overcome those costs. The inn's light fixtures also are equipped with energy-efficient LED bulbs, he added, which has further reduced costs. If you think about the amount of lights it takes to run a place like this, every little bit helps, he said. Just looking at the dining room, there's three chandeliers with 45 different bulbs between them. City of Dubuque Sustainability Director Gina Bell said it is fairly common for sustainability projects to pay for themselves in the long term. However, the upfront cost can be a barrier for many businesses. It can be hard when you're talking to a business owner and you have all these great ways to be more sustainable or save energy, but they all cost a lot of money, she said. It can be a real issue. To address that concern, several federal, state, and local programs have emerged to incentivize sustainable development by offering grants, low-interest loans, or rebates. Area colleges also have stepped up to help. Last fall, Southwest Tech launched its renewable energy program for students and in November received a $3 million grant from the U.S. Department of Energy to open an industrial assessment center in conjunction with two other colleges. Wotalowicz said the center will act as a resource for area businesses to connect with students and staff for assistance with efficiency audits, upskill training, and more. We are going to be putting into practice what we are trying to teach, she said. By reaching out to area businesses, we are hoping to show how much of a difference a program like this can make. The article is accompanied by several photographs of people mentioned in the article. One of them is Randy Tolle, T-H-O-L-E, and the other is of Royal Palmer. And the main picture is shows, as I read the caption earlier, store manager Nate Robinson. He's a friendly, bald-headed man with a blue apron, and he's standing behind a very attractive-looking a batch of stuffed green peppers. And now, turning to the opinion page, we have a couple of other view columns. The first is by frequent columnist and contributor Arthur Sear, who is the author of After the Cold War. And Arthur Sear's column today is headlined, Election Loss Weakens Turkey's President Erdogan. At the end of March, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan suffered a major political defeat, including but reaching well beyond the elections involved. The voters of the nation sent the autocratic courageous message of defiance. A sizable majority has re-elected opposition mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu by over 50% of the vote. This is a rerun of elections in 2019, where İmamoğlu first emerged victorious. The opposition Republican People's Party, known as the CHP, won 36 of the municipalities of Turkey's 81 provinces. A sizable portion of the new mayors elected are women, an extremely important positive development. Erdogan is no longer the predictable political winner. He did narrowly win a third term as president last May, while his Justice and Development Party, known as AKP, in alliance with another party, secured a strong parliamentary majority. In 2016, he personally turned back an attempted military coup using social media to urge the people to resist. That showed courage as well as cleverness. A national state of emergency was declared. Police arrested citizens before the national elections for publicly criticizing Erdogan. In April 2017 referendum gave expanded presidential powers. Erdogan and allies quickly declared victory after the voting, but their margin was narrow with accusations of irregularities. Turkey retains great strategic importance. First, the nation geographically spans Europe and Central Asia. Turkey can be a diplomatic bridge between Islam and the West. Turkey controls important sea and land shipping routes, including the Bosporus Strait that channels Black Sea access. Second, long term, since World War II, Turkey has maintained good relations with European nations and the United States. Current tensions overshadow this important history. Third, Turkey represents a unique marriage of firmly rooted Muslim religious and cultural attitudes with Western-style governmental and commercial institutions and practices. This draws on the nation's Ottoman history, which combined religious and firmly secular outlooks. In Lords of the Horizon, A History of the Ottoman Empire, Jason Goodwin notes that he writes about a people who do not exist. The word Ottoman does not describe a place. Nobody nowadays speaks their language. Only a few professors can begin to understand their poetry. Yet, for 600 years, the Ottoman Empire swelled and declined. Over the past four decades, Turkey's economy has enjoyed reform and expansion. Growth was strong until recently. Corruption and inflation were reduced, and government red tape and bottlenecks eliminated. Much of the credit belongs to reform Prime Minister and President Turgut Özal, who held office from 1983 to 1993. He was a close friend of President George H.W. Bush. While Turkey has had rocky relations with the European Union, the NATO alliance benefits from the nation's highly effective military. In the Korean and First Gulf Wars, Turkey was a significant military coalition partner. In Korea, Turkey's military reconfirmed once again their well-deserved reputation for combat effectiveness. In Afghanistan, Turkey had top command responsibilities over the years. Erdogan's autocratic behavior represents a challenge, yet modernization continues in Turkey. Opposition parties are established in parliament. Current economic weakness provides the political opposition opportunities and undercuts regime support. As in other parts of the world, public pressure grows for a modern standard of living. During the Cold War, Washington worked with unattractive governments for good practical reasons. Similar considerations apply today. Turgut Özal, along with G.H.W. Bush, deserve respect for mature leadership. Both had executive skill and personal integrity. In future, their examples should guide Turks and Americans. That was the Other View column submitted by Arthur I. Cyr, C-Y-R, author of After the Cold War, published by New York University Press and Palgrave Macmillan. And the Other View column is titled April, a Good Month to Raise Awareness of Distracted Driving. Tom Purcell, P-U-R-C-E-L-L, is the creator of the infotainment site Thurberstail.com. Tail is spelled T-A-I-L, Thurberstail.com, which is a Pittsburgh, and he's a Pittsburgh Tribune Review humor columnist. Tom Purcell's Other View column again is headlined, April, a Good Month to Raise Awareness of Distracted Driving. It wasn't my fault the car in front of me hit me. I glanced at my text message for only a second when our bumpers collided. How could the car in front of you hit you? The idiot stopped to let a deer cross the street and dented my front bumper with his rear bumper. Yet the cops wrote me up for texting while driving. It's because of people like you that April has become National Distracted Driving Awareness Month. Safety advocates are urging drivers like you to avoid texting or watching streaming video on their phones while behind the wheel of their cars. A whole month to make people aware of the risks of distracted driving? That's right. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says 3,522 people were killed in traffic crashes involving a distracted driver in 2021. And an estimated 362,415 people were injured. Look, I'm in sales and on the road a lot. I've gotten pretty good at talking, eating, texting, and driving. It wasn't my fault some idiot front-ended me. That's simply not true. According to the New York Times, a Michigan professor found that when someone tries to multitask, important neural regions in the brain must switch back and forth. This opens up opportunities for serious mistakes behind the wheel. But it's not my fault. My wife wants immediate answers when she texts me. Look, our roadways have changed significantly over the years. For starters, many of our cars are so comfortable and quiet, people forget they're operating a 2-ton hunk of steel. They're able to zone out to music or zap on the phone, oblivious to the millions of things that could go wrong. But I invested a lot of dough in my sound system. It would be a waste not to blast the speakers. To make matters more challenging, there are lots more cars on the road. According to Forbes, More than 97% of American households have one car, and nearly 23% have three or more. So we're a rich country. What's wrong with that? It only means that there are lots more drivers on the road, and drivers of any age and experience level. We know, for instance, that teen drivers are distracted more easily than other drivers, especially when their peers are in the car with them. My wife and I solved that problem. We got our daughter a 76 Pacer. She never leaves the house. That's funny. The point is, the more distracted drivers there are on the road, the greater the opportunity for accidents. And add to that challenge a mix of ever-changing technologies, smartphones, iPads, laptops, and GPS devices, and you have a recipe for disaster. You make some good points. Look, many people are wary of the government intervening in our lives, but there is wide agreement that this is one area where the government needs to intervene. Many states have implemented distracted driving laws, and with good reason. Okay, I agree with you, and I'll stop texting while driving, but please know that my driving skills are widely admired by other drivers. They even praise me when I cut them off. They do? Why else would they keep giving me the your number one finger gesture? That was the other view column, submitted by Tom Purcell, as I mentioned, creator of the infotainment site Thurber'sTale.com. Tom is a Pittsburgh Tribune Review humor columnist. We have one community letter today, and we'll get back to that later. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Thursday, April 11th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now, let's turn to today's obituaries. First, we look at the very brief listing of funeral services, and they are alphabetically listed. Brooke Anderson, Asbury, Iowa. Visitation 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. today, Hoffman, Schneider, and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory on Asbury Road. Amy L. Bainbridge, Galena, Illinois. Visitation 10 to noon Saturday, April 13, Furlong Funeral Chapel, Galena. Service noon Saturday at the chapel. William D. Bartles, Platteville, Wisconsin. Celebration of Life, 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday, April 14th, Veterans of Foreign Wars, Platteville. Donna J. Cook, Lancaster, Wisconsin. Visitation 9 to 11, Friday, April 12th, E.N.R. Church, Lancaster. The service 11 a.m. Friday at the church. May C. Dement, Dubuque. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. today, the Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Friday, April 12th, Nativity Catholic Church. Mary L. Haskins, Lancaster, Wisconsin. Visitation, 10 a.m. to noon today, St. Clement Catholic Church, Lancaster. Mass of Christian Burial, noon today at the church. Lorraine F. Heffel, H-E-F-E-L, Lorraine F. Heffel, North Buena Vista, Iowa. Visitation 2 to 7 p.m. today and from 9 to 10:30 a.m. Friday, April 12th, Immaculate Conception Parish Hall, North Buena Vista. Service 10:30 a.m. Friday at the church. Bernadette Hilby, Dubuque. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, April 12th, Egelhoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home on John F. Kennedy Road, and from 9 to 10:15 Saturday, April 13, Resurrection Catholic Church, Mass of Christian Burial, 10:15 a.m., Saturday at the church. Mary R. Johnson of Dubuque, Rosary Service, 9 a.m., Saturday, April 13, St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church, Visitation, 9:30 to 10:30, Saturday at the church. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Saturday at the church. James L. Klusner, K-L-U-E-S-N-E-R, James L. Klusner of Dubuque. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. today, Resurrection Catholic Church. Wilfred J. Rundy, R-U-N-D-E, East Dubuque, Illinois. Massive Christian burial, 10:30 a.m. Saturday, St. Mary's Catholic Church, East Dubuque. Judith C. Simonson, S-I-M-U-N-D-S-O-N, Judith C. Simonson, Roanoke, Illinois. Visitation and reception, 2 to 4 p.m. Saturday, April 13, Egelhoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory on John F. Kennedy Road. Wilfred E. Smithson, Bellevue, Iowa. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, April 12th, the Hockman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Bellevue, and from 1 to 2 p.m. Saturday, April 13, First Presbyterian Church, Bellevue, the service 2 p.m. Saturday at the church. Brenda J. Waters, W-A-T-T-E-R-S, Lancaster, Wisconsin. Celebration of Life, 2 to 5 p.m. Saturday, April 13th. Zippy's Brass Rail, Lancaster. And finally, Susan Wubena, W-U-B-B-E-N-A, Susan Wubena, Savannah, Illinois. Celebration of Life, 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, April 13, Eagles Club, Freeport. And that concludes the brief listings of today's, or this, the next few days' funeral services. And our regularly listed obituaries, Mary L. Walker, Lancaster, Wisconsin. Mary Louise, known as Mary Lou Walker, was age 90 of Lancaster when she passed away on Sunday, April 7th, at Grant Regional Health Center, Lancaster, surrounded by her loving family. A massive Christian burial will be held Saturday, April 13, 1 p.m. at St. Clement Catholic Church, Lancaster, Father Steve Bruner officiating. Burial will be at St. Clement Cemetery, Lancaster. Family and friends may call on Saturday from 10 a.m. until the time of services at the church. In lieu of plants and flowers, the family suggests memorials be given to St. Clement Catholic School and or Grant Regional Health Center, OB Department. Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Lancaster is entrusted with the care of Mary Lou and her family. And that's Mary Louise, Mary Lou Walker, age 90, of Lancaster. From Cascade, Edward J. Coffrin, K-O-F-R-O-N, Edward James Coffrin, 60, of Cascade, formerly of Janesville, Iowa, passed away peacefully, surrounded by his family, on April 10th, at his home in Cascade. A remembrance ceremony for Ed will be held at a later date. The Rife Funeral Home in Cascade is assisting the family with arrangements for Edward J. Coffrin, Cascade, Iowa. Bernadette, known as Bernie A. Hilby, H-I-L-B-Y, Nee Bernie, 91, of Dubuque, passed away peacefully on April 8th at Stonehill Care Center. Visitation Friday, April 12th, 4 to 7 p.m. at Egelhoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory on JFK Road, Dubuque. And on Saturday, from 9 to 10:15 a.m. at Resurrection Catholic Church, Dubuque. Mass of Christian burial will follow at 10:30 a.m. The Reverend Phil Gibbs officiating. Burial will follow at Resurrection Cemetery. And that is for Bernadette A. Hilby and the, as I mentioned, the Egelhoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory is entrusted with arrangements. Memorials can be given to the Dubuque Holy Family Catholic Schools or Resurrection Catholic Church. Deanna Edna Gulyash, G-U-L-Y-A-S-H, Deanna Edna Gulyash, 88, of Dubuque, died Monday, April 8th at Luther Manor. Funeral services, 11 a.m. Friday, April 12th at the Egelhoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory on JFK Road. A visitation will take place after 9 a.m. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery. And in lieu of flowers, a Deanna Gulyash Memorial Fund has been established. And as mentioned, the Egelhoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory is handling arrangements for Deanna E. Gulyash. Anna May Flammung, F-L-A-M-M-A-N-G, Anna May Flammung, 93, of Shakopee and formerly of Dubuque, died on Tuesday, April 9th. Visitation 9 to 11 a.m. Monday, April 15, at St. Joseph Catholic Church, Key West. Services will follow. Burial will follow in the Holy Rosary Cemetery in Lamont, Iowa. The Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory on Rockdale Road is assisting the family of Anna May Flammung of Shakopee, Minnesota. Linda M. Ries, R-I-E-S, of Bellevue, Iowa, was 74, and she died on Tuesday, April 9th. Visitation, 9:30 to 11:30, Monday, April 15, St. John Lutheran Church, Bellevue, where services will follow. The Hackman Meyer Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Bellevue is assisting the family of Linda M. Ries of Bellevue, Iowa. Anna May J. Blosch, B-L-O-S-C-H, Anna May J. Blosch, 90, of Darlington, Wisconsin, died on Wednesday, April 10th. Private services will be held. The Houdenshield Funeral Home and Crematory, Cuba City, is assisting the family of Anna May J. Blosch, Darlington, Wisconsin. And finally, Ralph Puckett Jr., a retired Army colonel, awarded the Medal of Honor 7 decades after he was wounded, leading a company of outnumbered Army Rangers in battle during the Korean War. He died at the age of 96. He died peacefully at his home Monday in Columbus, Georgia. According to the Stryfer Hamby Mortuary, which is handling funeral arrangements. That's for Ralph Puckett Jr. of Columbia, Georgia. And now we turn to the sports page for a prep story. The Shannon Mum reports on the Telegraph Herald Athletes of the Week. Wallert duo starts strong. Dubuque Wallert's sophomore duo of Evan Anderson and Chase Miller are proof that hard work pays off on the tennis court. The Telegraph Herald Athletes of the Week came up with a clutch point in the final doubles match for a come-from-behind 1-6, 7-6, 10-8 victory over Cedar Rapids Xavier last Thursday to give the Golden Eagles a 5-4 win. Top-ranked Xavier is the reigning state champ in Class 1A, having won the title in 2019, 2021, 2022, and 2023. "You're not winning matches like that by accident," Wallert coach Eric Lucy said. "They have put in so much time during the off-season playing against high-level competition in tournaments, and that's what it takes to have that kind of success." Anderson and Miller, who were the 6th and 7th players as freshmen last season, began playing together in doubles last summer. "From the first practice I saw them together, it was clear that they had something special there," Lucy said. "They are both very mature for being just sophomores, and they set good examples for the other guys on our team and for our younger junior varsity players." Added Anderson, "Chase and I met each other in baseball in the 5th grade, and we know each other really well. We started playing together this summer, and we really pick each other up during matches. We really hope that this can be our year to get it done at state, after finishing 3rd and last 3 years." Miller echoed that he and Anderson bring different skills to the court. "We have different skill sets, but we have the same mindset," Miller said. "We just play really well together. After getting beat pretty badly by Xavier last year, we knew we were going to have to work our butts off to get better, and coming into that match, we had a fire in us. That win gave us such a boost in our confidence." Lucy said both players have different strengths that make them a solid doubles team. "Chase has a focused confidence and a strong serve, while Evan has great court awareness and multiple shots in his arsenal," Lucy said. "They are both very calm and collected, which is rare for kids that young yet." Against Xavier, Lucy said that goal was to make it a close match after getting beat up last year. I really think they left Xavier stunned, he said. It was a huge, huge win for us. The article is accompanied by the athletes of the week, Evan Anderson and Chase Miller. We have some prep items in the local and area sports roundup. First of all, we have a prep softball story, Eastland 10, River Ridge Scales Mound 3. At Hanover, Illinois, Lake and Haas went 3-for-4 with a double to River Ridge Scales Mound, which jumped to an early 2-0 lead. But Eastland hung crooked numbers in his second through fifth innings to pull away for the NUIC victory. Eastland finished with a 12-5 advantage to make up for 4 errors. In girls prep golf, Bobcats win Mississippi Valley Conference Triangular. At Thunder Hills Country Club, CC Ball shot 1 over par 37 for medalists honors. McKenna Stackus shot 40, Amber Wilson carded a 41, and Natalie Fangman had a 42 as Western Dubuque, with a total of 160, defeated Cedar Rapids Xavier with a 168, and Iowa City West totaled 215 in a Mississippi Valley Conference Triangular on Tuesday. Rams second. At Dubuque Golf and Country Club, Evan Deutsch carded a 49 as Dubuque senior with a total of 209, finished behind Iowa City High at 190 in a Mississippi Valley Conference quadrangular. Eagles third. At Cedar Rapids, Iowa, Ava Kalb shot 35 and Sophia Thier a 38 as Dubuque Wallert with a total 156, finished behind Lynn Mars 150 and Cedar Falls 152 in a Mississippi Valley quadrangular. And finally, Mustangs fourth. At the Meadows, Danny McQuillan shot a 47 as Hempstead took fourth in a Mississippi Valley Conference quadrangular won by Cedar Rapids, Washington. And that concludes the sports news focusing on prep stories today. Returning to the opinion page, we have a letter to the editor submitted by Janelle Lutgen, L-U-T-G-E-N, of Elm Street, Bernard, Iowa. The emergency insulin bill was first filed in 2019 as companion bills. The bills, House File 447, 96-0, and Senate File 291, 490, passed both the House and the Senate unanimously. But the Senate version had an insurance mandate. This meant if the person's insurance had coverage for insulin, then the insurance company would pay according to their policy. The House bill did not have the insurance requirement. The state of Ohio passed Kevin's Law, emergency insulin bill, without the insurance coverage and had to go back last year to add it on. When the Iowa bill went back to the House, it was never brought back to the floor for a vote. The reason given was, this is what makes health care costs go up. What makes health care costs go up is a diabetic rationing their insulin, if they survive. The costs of an ER visit, hospitalization, and or lifelong care of the nerve damage caused by rationing all exceed the cost of one vial of insulin, which would have been covered had the doctor been reached. Under Iowa's current emergency medication law, all medications are paid as usual by the insurance company. The law allows the pharmacist to dispense medication in a 72-hour increment. Insulin does not come in that small of dose. Neither do inhalers or EpiPens. All three are vital for those who need them. The emergency insulin bill is not about affordability. If your doctor cannot be reached for authorization, you will not get your insulin. This is about accessibility. That was the letter to the editor submitted by Janelle Lutgen on Elm Street in Bernard, Iowa. And on the Dubuque and Tri-State page, A2, we have a story by Elizabeth Kelsey, Maquoketa District eyes portion of City Park for elementary school expansion. Maquoketa Community School District officials seek to purchase part of a city park adjacent to Briggs Elementary School to accommodate the expansion of that school and the closure of another. The district plans to purchase about an acre of green space at the northwest corner of Little Bear Park, according to Superintendent Tara Knotts. In December, school board members approved the closure of Cardinal Elementary following an expansion to Briggs Elementary that would support the grade levels currently at Cardinal. Briggs serves 3rd through 5th grade students, while Cardinal houses pre-kindergarten through 2nd grades. Cardinal was constructed in the 1970s and is an open concept building, meaning it has few walls, and classrooms have been created using temporary drywall, filing cabinets, and curtains. School officials have said the layout poses problems in terms of safety, noise, and energy efficiency. Knott said this week that while the layout of the Briggs expansion is not finalized, the building will likely span part of North Decker Street, which separates the school from Little Bear Park. The part of the park the district plans to purchase, however, would not become part of the building itself. It could be used for parking, or part of it could remain as green space depending on the final layout of the building, Knott said. City Manager Josh Bolt said the section of Little Bear Park the Maquoketa District plans to purchase represents about half of the park. It does not include any of the city-owned infrastructure currently in the park, including a playground and restroom structure. Those features are not all at all a part of the proposed transaction, said Bolt. The school and the city recognize that it's best for that area to maintain its continuing use as a playground and park for people to enjoy. Both Bolt and Knotts declined to share the estimated purchase price for the land, stating that it will be discussed in an upcoming public hearing on the sale. The date for that hearing is yet to be set, according to Bolt, but Knotts said the sale should be finalized within the next few months, as the district plans to seek bids on the project in late summer or early fall. Maquoketa officials hope to break ground on the Briggs expansion and renovation in 2025 and have the new spaces ready for students and staff by the 2027-2028 school year. The district plans to fund the approximately $15 million project by borrowing against revenue from the 1 cent Secure and Advanced Vision for Education sales tax. The article is accompanied by pictures of those mentioned, Tara Knotts and Josh Bolt. And finally, the weather predicted for tomorrow is sunny and breezy with a high of 59, a low of 39. The wind will be from the northwest, 12 to 25 miles per hour. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for this Thursday, April 11th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.